You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And in the studio today with me, I've got explorer and author Justin Miles. We'll also hear from performance poet Neil Hilborn, and academic Joe Herbert will be talking about his book, Studying the Effects of Testosterone on Men and Women. But first of all, hello, Justin. Nice to have you with us on Bookmark.
Good morning. It's nice to be here again.
And this is a little bit of a macho show, so all men, we're talking about testosterone. But female explorers, we're used to hearing about Bear Grylls and Ranulph Fiennes. There are female explorers, presumably?
There are loads, loads and loads and loads, and very easy to find.
Yes, and they are as successful as the men?
Probably more so right now.
What do you think it is that makes a female explorer successful? Do they have a different part? You know, are there female qualities that work better in that role?
Do I really have to answer this question?
Yes.
there are. I guess everybody's got different qualities. It comes down to the personality. That's my cop out answer.
And what about you? Are you conscious when you're out there of using different parts of your brain?
I tend not to use too many parts of my brain. You just go into sort of zombie mode and go for it.
Go for it. Well, we'll hear all about you going for it rather appropriately after your first choice of music, which is Don't Stop Me Now. Why this one?
Why not? It's an awesome piece of music. It was when I was recovering from brain damage quite a long time ago now. I couldn't walk or talk. And this came on quite a lot and I loved it.
Fading away there, the sound of Queen and Don't Stop Me Now, the first choice of music from our studio guest on Bookmark today, Justin Miles. Justin is a professional adventurer and explorer. He has visited polar, mountain, desert and jungle regions. Education is at the core of each of his expeditions, and all are used to support global projects engaging with school children around the world. In fact, he estimates that he connects with 4,500 children a month via virtual workshops and lectures. His books include Ultimate Explorer Guide for Kids and Ultimate Guide to Mapping, described by The Guardian as navigation tools every young explorer needs. So, Justin, you're a professional adventurer and explorer. What does that mean?
It means I get to go on holiday to the coolest places on earth, do some really fun stuff and meet great people along the way.
And be paid for it. Professional implies payment.
You don't get paid very much. Nobody actually pays you to do this job, so that's a bit of artistic license maybe with that. My income is from speaking, from writing. Everything I do in education is free and nobody wants to pay you to go on holiday. I mean, nobody wants to pay you to go to the North Pole.
And the places that you choose to go to, how do you choose them?
It used to be that I would look for big, bad and dangerous stuff. These days, it's more to do with the education opportunities that arise from those expeditions. So as an example, I did Kenya, climbed Mount Kenya, did some work on volcanoes out there. Lots of that connected back to education programs around the world. And it also raised awareness of education issues across East Africa.
Well, let's backtrack just a little bit, because this came about through actually an awful accident.
Yeah, I've always been quite adventurous. As a young boy, I grew up in South Devon, so I had the moors and the rivers and the lakes and the streams and the coast. And it was a fantastic petri dish for anybody with a bit of a thirst or interest in adventure. And every young boy did it at my age. And then when I got to the age of 26, obviously my adventurous lifestyle had been relegated to evenings and weekends with work and things and extended holidays. And then I had a car crash, and it was awesome because I had a car crash. I was brain damaged. I had to learn to walk and talk all over again from scratch. And when I was going through that process, people sat me in front of a television to keep me occupied because I couldn't move. There were only four TV channels. Bearing in mind, I lived in Devon. One of those channels was very flaky at best. And there's only so much daytime TV that anyone can watch, whether you're brain damaged or not. So I just sort of relegate and go back into my own mind and remember my dreams and aspirations as a child. And one of them was about becoming a full-time explorer, adventurer type person. And I thought, I can do this. So that became my objective that saw me through my recovery. And then just made it happen.
You described that accident there as awesome. Are you glad you had the accident?
At the time I wasn't, but now I am. At the time, obviously, it was pretty awful. I couldn't walk properly. I couldn't speak. Well, I couldn't walk at all. Couldn't speak properly. I was a bit of a wreck. But now, looking back on it, I think if I had continued on that path that I was on before the accident, I wouldn't have done anywhere near as many interesting things as I do today.
And the effects of the accident, are they still with you now?
Sometimes, yeah. The fitness came back very quickly. At the time of the accident, the medical team, I didn't really take very much medical advice, but they were telling my family to expect 5-year protracted recovery, at the end of which I could go back to work part-time. I disagreed, so 9 months later I did a marathon. It took 8¾ hours, but I did the marathon. 2 years later I did a marathon distance run every week for a year, and then just crack on and make it happen.
And do you feel the effects of the injuries now? I mean, because I'm guessing with exploring, you are testing your body to its limits.
But brain damage is a different kind of injury. It's not something where you go, I've got a bad leg or a bad arm. It's an invisible injury. So it confused the messages between my brain and my body, which is why nothing worked. You know, it wasn't like as though my legs were broken, that the connection was broken. And then the other side of it is that it does change the way that you think and feel, your emotional states, the way you act and react, the way that you manage relationships. Everything changes. It was a pretty tough, dark time in the early years. Cost me a lot of friendships, cost me my marriage ultimately. But now I think I'm a much better person for it.
And this all ties in with your campaign, really, about education. Where did that come from, that interest in education?
Believe it or not, when I was younger, I did think about training to become a teacher, but decided I wasn't intelligent enough. So I went off and did other things. So I've always had an interest. And then through my projects, a lot of schools came to me and exhibitions, a lot of schools would come to me and say, can we use this? Can you talk to us? Can you do stuff? And then I was very fortunate in that I went out and spent some time in Doha with a program out there called Educate a Child. And that's where my education about education really began, and the global education crisis. The fact that there are tens of millions of children around the world who, for a whole plethora of reasons, are denied access to education. And I thought, I want to do something to help with this. Interestingly, since I saw you last, about a year ago, it was a year ago, September, I launched a program called Teach the World, which gives me a platform to engage schools around the world in developed countries and areas with developed education systems. And talk about barriers to education, and it works so far in 12 months with a zero budget, but a few very good strategic partners. We estimate that the program's been touched by around 2.5 million teachers worldwide. So if you then multiply that by the number of children that have been involved, it gives us a good scope, because the children that we make aware of this problem now, that we educate, that we inspire and motivate and empower to make a difference, they'll grow up in 15 years, 20 years time to be the educators, the business people, the political leaders that can make education happen for everyone.
And the books, how did the books come about? The books have obviously come out through the exploring.
Well, the true story is I was at the education show at Birmingham NEC, and I was walking around and bumped into this lady who was working for one of the publishers. And we got chatting, and she said, we'd like a coffee. And she said, but have you thought about writing a book? I'm like, yeah, kind of, but not a kid's book. So we talked about it, and she said it'd be a really good thing to do. And that was it. And then about 8 months, 10 months later, the phone rang out of the blue, having never spoken to her again since. I said, just, can you write that book now? So that was it. So that was how the first book came out. And it came out, it's out in 24 languages, I think, and all over the world. And it's been a really good seller. And then as that came out, then people were asking, what's the key skill for an explorer, a key skill for an adventurer? And I thought, I don't know, is it cooking? Is it being able to choose the right kit? Well, one of the key skills is navigation, and that gave rise to the second book about navigation. And one of the weirdest moments through the whole project was when I was at the Edinburgh Book Festival with the publisher, and they got me a glass of scotch and said, we wanted to tell you, whilst we're here, that in the first week that your second book came out, the government of Chile bought 5,000 copies.
Wow.
So that was
wow,
that was
so
pretty
cool. You're big in Chile.
Yeah, it was really good.
They're great fun to read, and they're beautifully designed, and they're great to look at. You can see why they're so appealing to children. Well done.
Thanks.
Now, poetry. Are you a fan of poetry?
But when a few years ago, I haven't done it so much now because my mind's in other things, but a few years ago, I was really quite into performance poetry. And I did the whole sort of MC thing at a few poetry slams. And my personal preference was for World War One poetry in particular. So the greats are Sue Owen and Brooks and so on.
Oh, well, hopefully you'll be interested in our guest now. It's Neil Hilborn. He's a slam poet. His writing often details personal experiences and battles with mental illness. His poem, OCD, has had more than 75 million views on YouTube and elsewhere, making it unofficially the most watched poem ever. I suggested to Neil when we met that it was pretty typical of his work.
I try to write personal narrative as much as possible. It's funny, when I started off, I always wrote like persona pieces, or I wrote things that were about other people. I never like wrote my own personal story, and I didn't understand why I kept losing poetry slams and why nobody liked my stuff at open mics. And then somebody was like, hey, Neil, that's because it's not genuine. You're not revealing any part of yourself. And so that's what I really tried to do. Try to be as open and as genuine as possible, because I think that's actually how to reach a broader audience, is to just be as personal and truthful as you can. You
but
know?
How do you protect yourself in that process? Because you really do expose yourself.
Totally. There's some things about myself that I just don't write about that allows me to think like, yes, there's definitely parts of me that I reveal. So about 4 years ago when OCD blew up, that's when I started touring full time and sort of became much more of a internet persona. I don't know what you'd call it. I kind of, not split my personality, but I developed this persona where the guy in the videos and the guy on stage, that's Neil Hilborn. So there are a lot of things that I'll write about as Neil Hilborn, and those are the poems that go on stage and go in the books and things like that. But then there's some stuff that like I'll write about that's just Neil, like me in my everyday life, I'm just Neil. So I'll still write poems about other things that I'm going through, other topics, like Neil Hilborn doesn't necessarily talk about, but those are just for me. Like, I'm never going to show them to anybody. The really sensitive stuff and the stuff I really don't want to talk about, I just don't do it. That's how I've tried to protect myself.
Also, one of the things I noticed in your YouTube performances is the energy that you put into it. Quite draining a performance, is it?
Definitely. yeah, I mean, it really is. In a weird way, it's also energizing, merely because I feel like when I'm putting a whole bunch of energy into a room or toward an audience, that audience is giving me that energy back. If a show goes really well, I get off stage and I'm like, I feel physically tired, but emotionally I'm like totally charged. I'm ready to go. And like, it takes me like a while to get to sleep afterward and stuff like that. But it definitely is. It's pretty exhausting.
And how do you pump yourself up before a performance then?
Pretty standard stuff. Like, I'm just hanging out before a show. I'm just hanging out in the green room, play some music on my phone and my headphones. And I kind of just like pace around, or I'll like run poems. So usually what I do is like, you know, I've got some poem that I'm actively memorizing right now. It takes me a long time to memorize poems. If I'm in the green room, probably about 10, 15 minutes before I go on, I just start running the poem, just to kind of get myself in this mindset. And then I kind of trick myself into not thinking about going on stage because I'm doing this other thing. And then suddenly I'm like, oh, it's 8:30, gotta go.
So how many poems do you hold in your head then?
At a time, probably, let me think. So my set is about 18 or 19 poems. 4 of them aren't memorized. So like, there's the 15 poems that go on stage, but then I've probably got another 5 or 10 in my pocket at any given time. I think right now I could probably produce 25, 30 poems just on demand. I think, man, I don't really know. I have a lot of memory problems. Like, I've had several major concussions. My memory's just a little messed up. But I'm pretty sure I could produce poems that, like, I maybe haven't done in a year or two, but that, like, I'd already performed so much. They're kind of just ingrained in my physical memory. So,
do you remember the first poem you ever wrote?
Oh, God, yeah. the first poem or the first spoken word poem?
Well, yes, that's the thing. First poem and then maybe your first spoken word poem. At what stage? That's another question, isn't it? What stage did you move from being a written poet on the page to being a spoken word poet?
The first poem I ever wrote, I was like 8 years old. You know the comic strip, Calvin and Hobbes? In the beginning of a lot of the collections, there'd be a full color, longer form thing that Bill Watterson would do. And there was one where there was this like really cool, huge drawing of the moon or something. And I got really inspired. So I wrote a poem about like nighttime, you know. It was cute. It was cute. And then I wrote, I mean, pretty much throughout like the rest of my childhood and through being a teenager, I like knew I wanted to go to college for poetry and knew I like eventually wanted to be a professor. But I started doing spoken word when I was 19. Now a good friend of mine, at the time I didn't know who he was, Dylan Garrity, showed up to a meeting of my literary magazine with a spoken word poem. He wanted the workshop. And he just like stood up and he did this really terrible poem. It was just so bad. God, it was so bad. But, you know, we were all bad back then. I've never seen anybody do poetry like this because he was really, you know, loud and but like really earnest and really genuine about it. So, yeah, he took me to some poetry slams and open mics in the Twin Cities. And now it's almost 10 years later and it's my full time job. So.
And some of your poems are quite challenging, not just for you standing up there talking about these things, but for the listeners, for your audience as well.
Yeah, definitely. I don't believe in giving the audience breaks. And obviously, you know, there will be times when like tension really builds and then I'll like make a joke and relieve some of that tension. But I think that's important for people to comprehend stuff. Like literally, it was in a creative writing class of mine. One of my professors was like, never let your characters off the hook. If you create a situation or you create a problem for them, don't just let them out of it. Keep throwing problems at them. Keep making it more and more difficult. You know, I mean, a lot of my set's pretty funny. I try to be funny and entertaining because people aren't trying to have really serious feelings for an hour. But definitely in the more serious parts of my set, yeah, I don't really give I don't give people a break. Just because I think that, you know, if they show up, I think people are a lot of time expecting a pretty intense emotional experience and expecting some kind of catharsis to come out of it. And so I'm like, all right, let's do this. Stuff's going to get real sad for a little bit.
And I suppose, as you say, you're sort of building a narrative as a show. A show isn't just sticking lots of poems together, is it? It's about pace and timing and emotional depth.
100%. I mean, for me, it's not so much like that there's an explicit like narrative that runs throughout the thing, but I try to definitely build an emotional arc into the set, like not to reveal too many of my tricks, but I try to come out and be funny and light at the beginning. Like, I mean, literally the way it works is like my first poem is just a big, silly, funny poem. And then I do a funny poem that turns to serious at the end. And I do one or two genuinely just sad poems. And I say right there, I'm like, hey, I'm gonna do a couple sad poems. And then I do a whole bunch of funny poems. But I've like given this hint of like, hey, stuff's going to get weird in a little bit. And then I do a lot of sad poems. Then I try to bring it inspirational at the end. So yes, emotional arc. That's really what I'm trying to do.
And you've got a book as well, Our Numbered Days. Did you change any of the poetry to put on the printed page? Or does it all stand? Can you take a performed poem, as it were, and put it on the page without alteration?
In an ideal world, all of my poems would function perfectly well, both on the page and on stage, right? But that's not... I'm not that good, you know? So I think that there are definitely performance versions and written versions of every poem. The changes aren't huge. There's some words that I just put in specifically for cadence, or they just look dumb on the page, or like there might be spots where like I repeat myself in a poem because the audience doesn't have time to like sit with a poem that you put on the page. So I think the performative versions are much more streamlined, and there are a lot more like things in there to kind of hold the audience's hand a little bit more. But on the page, I'm like, oh, if you want to know, you read the poem. You know what I mean? So there's definitely, there's a difference.
And I guess when you tell people you're a performance poet, people say, perform me a poem.
Right. And I'm like, no. it's like, I hear this from like comedians also, or a lot of time, like, you know, if I'm just hanging out at a bar and, you know, somebody's like, oh, what do you do? I'm like, oh, I'm a spoken word poet. I perform professionally. And I'm going to kind of steal a joke from a comedian, Hannibal Buress here. But like, you know, and they're always like, you know, do a poem. And I'm like, oh yeah, definitely. You know, normally when I perform poems, there's a stage and there's lights and an audience and a microphone and a sound system and a proper concert. context for poems, but really that's, you know, that's totally the same as doing a poem to your face right here in this bar for free. So yeah, I'm definitely...
So I can't tempt you to do a poem now.
Oh, I'd love to do a poem. This is the proper context. Are you
okay,
kidding me?
Great.
Yeah, no, for sure, man. This is great. What kind of poem do you want of my arsenal of 25, 30 poems? What can I get out for you?
Well, give us an upbeat poem.
Sure, I got you. Cool, great. I remember this poem a while ago. It's about kissing and it's stupid. It's called Static Electricity. In second grade, we did an experiment with static electricity. We rubbed balloons on our heads and stuck them to walls, and kissing you is kind of like that. My hair stands on end. I get shocked when I touch things. I want to tell you stupid stuff like kissing you is a bundle of kittens colliding with my face at 0.5 miles an hour. It's like being shot with a dart gun made of hummingbirds that shoots darts made of hummingbirds. And your lips are so soft, I can't actually tell when we're touching, like braiding hair underwater or napping under a blanket filled with rainbows and clouds and your favorite books. When you kiss me, the cartoon devil and angel on my shoulder climb into my ears, lick all my neurons, and start making out on my brainstem. And if you were a 300-pound professional weightlifter and I were a Kia Sorento, you could drag me anywhere with your lips. Kissing you is patient and impossibly slow, like peeling paint off a wall with glittery stickers or cooking a turkey with a lighter. And knowing I would someday kiss someone who kisses like you is why I let them give me braces. It's why I even wore my headgear to school. See, you remind me of the time in second grade when Bethany Hopkirk called me a freak face and stabbed me in the arm with a pencil, because kissing you is kind of like that. Unhealthy and will probably result in disfigurement, but baby, bring on the facial scars and lead poisoning. Because when you kiss me, you are dangling me off a bridge by my belt. You are the screen door in my childhood, all teeth and swinging, so full of holes you could never keep anything in. You are every black eye. You're a semi-truck and I'm a turtle with two broken legs and a broken heart. You wear illegal fireworks, falling downstairs together, driving on four flat tires, playing frisbee at night with a saw blade. Kissing you is like falling out of a 37-story window, exploding into a cloud of robins, and reappearing on the ground with my mouth full of feathers. And when I can't kiss you, I try to find the electricity in my apartment. I dig around in wall sockets, I change light bulbs with my teeth, and I make out with a toaster. I know we've only been seeing each other for a couple weeks, but when you kiss me, I can't remember my middle name or which one is my left foot, so come over tonight. We'll shuffle around the apartment in our socks, and we'll let our lips drift toward each other like tectonic plates made out of kittens.
Tectonic plates made out of kittens. How wonderful is that? That's Neil Hilborn, and his book, Our Numbered Days, is published by SCB Distributed Publishers. Did you enjoy that, Justin Miles?
It was awesome.
It was awesome.
I really enjoyed it.
Well, Neil, they're talking about being on stage. I mean, it feels as though it, probably saying he's getting energy back from the audience. It feels as also it's quite lonely on stage. Is it lonely being an explorer? Do you go to these places on your own?
Sometimes I go on my own. Sometimes I do it with other people. It can be lonely, but you just suck it up, crack on. It won't be lonely at the end.
No, when you get back to civilization, it's
absolutely
not really. And I'm guessing that while you were out there, you've had some near-death experiences.
I've had one or two incidents. A couple of years ago, I can't remember how many years ago, one of the problems with brain damage is it's knocked my chronology. So last week could be last year, who knows. I think it was 2012 or 13. I was on my way to the North Pole exploring a new route. I slipped on the ice, felt a pain in my abs. I thought I'd pulled a muscle. Now, my job, you get broken fingers, broken toes, bits of frostbite, whatever. You can't do anything about it. You can't have a duvet day. You can't go home. You can't get your mum to write a letter. You have to man up and crack on. But the next day, it caused quite a lot of pain. So I stripped off. It was quite a warm day. It was only about minus 27. So I stripped off and phoned back to Cambridge and spoke with Rod McKenzie of Magpass, the air ambulance charity. Rod spoke to me about the injury. He then talked my colleague through a bit of a field diagnosis. And it turned out that I'd had, in effect, a giant hernia. I'd unzipped from my chest all the way down to my belly button. And things were outside that shouldn't have been outside. And it wasn't very comfortable. So I had to lay down on the floor, manipulate everything back through the hole, wrap myself up with duct tape, and then walk very slowly and painfully and carefully back to Greenland so that I could fly home for surgery. And now I've got bionic abs.
Now you've got bionic abs.
Absolutely. But I do support Magpass all the way. They saved me even when I was 2,600 miles away.
In a situation like that, obviously it's having presence of mind and just staying calm that's as important as knowing what to do, I guess.
It was the biggest challenge for me was thinking, I've trained for this for 18 months, 2 years. We've done all of this preparation and now I'm going home because my body let me down. And that was not a pleasant feeling at all.
How do you come to terms with something like that? Because you must be, angry.
Yeah, you're angry, disappointed. I got home, it was Christmas Eve. My partner was going away on holiday for 5 days with her mother because I wasn't meant to be there. So I sat at home on my own and you just sort of argue with yourself and talk it through. When I had the surgery, the doctor said, look, you need to give it at least a year before you start training again. I said, that doesn't really fit because in 5 months' time, I'm back up in the Arctic doing a paddleboard trip. So it gave me something else to look forward to. Objectives and goals are important in everything.
And let's talk about the books now, Ultimate Explorer Guide and Ultimate Mapping Guide. All that experience that you have, all that knowledge, when it comes to putting it down on paper, I mean, just where did you start?
Well, the first book, the aim of the first book was to encourage kids to get active outdoors. And I thought, OK, what can go in this? So it was my first book and I'd never dreamt of writing a children's book before. So the publishers worked with me to manage me, I guess, but to tell me the sort of things that I should be looking at, shouldn't be looking at. And I delivered probably 5 times too much content, which then we worked together and trimmed it back. But I was very finicky about what I wanted the book to look like. And it's been really quite strange because as well as being used to encourage kids to get outdoors all over the world, it's also used in education to encourage literacy and improve literacy. Because I wrote it in bite-sized chunks so that kids can pick up on any page, read a short paragraph, learn something and move on. So there's a stealth learning element and it helps to improve literacy because it sort of mirrors the way that kids learn through the internet, the way that they use Facebook and Twitter and social media accounts. So that was really good. And then the second book was just, again, being picked up by classrooms all over the world. They're using the learning exercises, the geography. They're looking at how satellite technology works, all sorts of stuff. So the spin-off from these books has been absolutely amazing and taken me to places that I never thought I'd ever visit.
They are brilliant. I'm going to ask you some questions from your books. I'm going to give you a heads up on that in just a moment. But we're going to hear your second choice of music now, which is Kashin and All In My Head. Why this one?
I've always been a fan of Kashin since I was in my late teens. And a couple of months ago, I was very lucky. I was on stage at the Atlas concert speaking about outdoor stuff whilst the pop concert was going on. And I actually got to meet Sian Evans from Kashin, and she explained to me why she wrote this song.
Mark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations rather than books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers, and my studio guest today, explorer and author Justin Miles. Go on then, Justin, you've got to put us out of our misery now. We heard just then Kashin and All In My Head. Why did she write that song then?
She wrote it when she was on the road, and it was all about being away from her family. The family are always in her mind, and that's where the song came from.
Well, when you're away, thinking of that, your family and the people you love must be very much on your mind. How do you cope with the separation from them?
Do you know, I really miss my dogs. and obviously I miss my partner as well, but I really miss my dogs because I can't talk to them ever. But you just have to recognise that you're going to go through a bit of a homesick session. It could be a few hours, it could be a couple of days. You just move on.
You just park that.
Yeah, just try and park it as much as you can. You've got to focus on the task in hand.
And do you take things like music with you?
No, I can't listen to. I love music, and I'm always listening to music. Apart from if I train, I exercise in any way, I can't have music on in my ears. Or if I'm on an expedition, I absolutely hate it. You're in the most wonderful places on earth. Why ruin it by bringing music?
And wonderful places on earth. What is the most wonderful place you've been to?
The Cambridge 105 studio.
Of course. After this.
After that, I don't know. It's really difficult because I can genuinely say I've enjoyed everywhere I've been. I've been to some pretty strange places, but everywhere's been great, often because of the people that I meet.
And what's the toughest place you've been to then, on the flip side of that?
Again, the Cambridge 105 studio.
Oh, good.
The toughest place. I don't know. Everywhere's tough in different ways. You know, sometimes, but with my education work, sometimes I go to some pretty horrific places, and it's tough to see people struggle, and it's tough to see that sort of stuff. Yeah, so... Yeah, let's move on. Next question.
Right. OK, well, let's go to your books. Are you happy for me to fling some questions at you from your books? We'll find out now if you really did write them, Justin. How do you remove a leech?
How do you remove a leech? How do I remove a leech?
Yes. How does one remove a leech?
Yeah, there's all sorts of ways of removing a leech. The one, you know, I can't remember which way is in the book, but I tend to use some sort of, I'm pretty garish, so I just use whatever I've got to hand, really. A match sometimes works.
Ooh.
Or a little bit of heat and fire is a quick, really, really quick way.
And you have had to remove leeches by the sound of it?
Only a couple of times. I've been quite lucky with the leeches.
Ugh. And how do you find water in the desert?
You look for your nearest McDonald's or you look in your backpack where you take it. There are lots of ways, lots of answers to this question. You can create a solar still. You can collect water from cactus by bagging any foliage on plants. So you put a plastic bag over it. And then the condensation will be collected, and then you can drink that water. There are lots of different ways. You can find dry riverbeds and dig down, and there should be moisture at the bottom.
And somebody who's had altitude sickness, what do you do when you've got altitude sickness, or when you've had it?
Do you know, I've never had altitude sickness when I've been climbing or mountaineering. I had altitude sickness once when I went skiing, which was really weird because I'd just come back off of a big peak and then came back, went skiing and got altitude sickness. The best treatment is to descend to a level where you don't feel so ill, acclimatise and go back again.
I would agree. I've had altitude sickness. It is no fun. I can tell you that. So this mapping guide as well. I'm quite intrigued by mapping. It sounds very hard, mapping. Is it as hard as it sounds?
No, not at all. The thing with navigation and being able to understand maps is learn it in a very tiered, layered approach. So the first question is, what is a map? A map is just a picture of an area as if seen from above. So it could be this office, it could be the entire world, who knows? Depends on the map you're looking at. Obviously, a 3D map is the globe. So the book starts off with asking the question, what is a map? Now create your own map. Draw a picture of your bedroom or your living room or whatever, then your house and your garden. Then we overlay it with graphs and scales, and you just build it up. A lovely little exercise to learn how contours work, so you can create your own contour map. And once you understand how to create a map, then you can use one.
You've made it sound so easy, Justin. Thank you. Right, we're going to take a sort of slight sideways step now. We're going to find out about testosterone. We talked about it earlier on in the show. Joe Herbert is Emeritus Professor of Neuroscience at Cambridge University and a Fellow of Gonville and Caius. His areas of expertise include the role of hormones on the brain and how they influence decision making. He's authored and co-authored around 250 scientific papers. His latest book, Testosterone, the Molecule Behind Power, Sex and the Will to Win, explores the implications of research findings into the hormone. When I met Joe, I asked him what had drawn him to this particular area of neuroscience.
Some of the most powerful chemicals in your body are hormones, and they have huge effects on the whole of your physiology, but also on your behaviour. And I'm particularly interested in the way in which hormones affect the brain and the brain affects the hormones, because the two together work together and they regulate surprising amount of what you do and who you are.
And this book is aimed at a general reader?
Yes. I think it's important for scientists to try to explain to people what they do. There's a whole core of scientific journalists who try to interpret science for the rest of the public, but that's not quite the same. You need to hear it from the scientists themselves to understand why they're doing things they are doing and what they're doing and what they hope to achieve and what it all means. Don't forget that a large amount of the science in this country is supported by public funds, taxes. So apart from anything else, we owe it as a duty to tell people what we're doing with their money.
And as someone so immersed in science, you wanted this to be for a general reader, so you wanted it to be accessible. How hard was it for you to go back to thinking what a general reader would understand and what they wouldn't understand?
Well, I like literature. I read a lot of literature which is not scientific. But I think what you do is you sit there and you imagine you're talking to someone through the computer, you know, somebody who isn't in your field. Some of you met at a party, say, or at a dinner, and they say to you, what do you do? And you say, well, I do this. But also you try to convey some of your own excitement, because scientists are chronically excited by what they do, rightly, because it's the most extraordinary, enthralling experience being a research scientist, and you want to convey that as well as the ball facts.
Well, the ball facts as well, and testosterone, this is a hormone. There are still, as you say in the book, missing pieces of this jigsaw puzzle.
There's missing pieces of all jigsaw puzzles in science, and in particular the brain. Let's not be bashful about this. I'm a neuroscientist, a professor of neuroscientists, and the first thing I say to my students is, I know rather little about the brain. And they all laugh politely. But in fact, I'm being absolutely truthful, because the brain is really one of the last great mysteries of the body. The big problem is to explain how it does what we know it does. We can describe all the things the brain does, but the question then is, how does the brain do all that? And that's where you come up against lots of brick walls.
And you describe testosterone in the book as the most influential hormone.
It's hugely influential. Without it, neither you or I would be here, neither would any other human being, neither would any bird or reptile or fish.
You could say that about estrogen, though.
You couldn't, actually. Not so much. Of course, testosterone isn't the only thing. You need lots of other things too. But it's the one essential thing you need for reproduction. I suppose you're right, really, that estrogen is also essential. Many other things are essential too. I mean, having a womb is essential. Having a uterus is essential. You know, but without them all, nothing would happen without testosterone.
And one of the surprising things I found from the book was how early it begins to exert its influence on men or boys or babies.
Yeah. The three great testosterone surges in a man's life. The first one when he's about 10 or 12 weeks old in the womb. And that's probably very important, because the brain at that point is developing and it's exposed to this great surge of testosterone, and that does remarkable things to the brain and probably programs it in a direction which we call masculinity. There's some controversy about that. There are people, particularly in the feminist movement, who don't believe in the concept of masculinity and femininity. They believe that all sex differences are artificial or socially imposed. That's not true. Of course, there are many differences which are socially imposed. We know that because they vary across history and across geography. But the fact remains that it's a basic biology as well. And the basic biology starts very early, right in the womb. And then they tend to get to sleep until after the little boy is born. And what will surprise many mums when they look at their little boy about 3 or 4 months old in their pram is their testosterone levels at that point are about as high as their father's. So there's a second great surge just after birth. The fascinating thing is no one really knows what that does, if anything. Now, scientists tend to dismiss things and say it's not important. Experience tells you you should never do that, because at some point people will discover what it's for. There have been lots of theories, but no real demonstration. The real problem is it doesn't occur in things like rats and dogs and other animals, which we can experiment on. So you have to rely upon observations on humans. Then, of course, the third great surge is puberty, and we all know about that.
And you mentioned masculinity there, and testosterone has become very much a word associated with macho-ness, hasn't it? You assume that somebody who's very aggressive in their life, very successful, is full of testosterone. Is that the case?
Yes, it's a kind of metaphor, isn't it, for manliness. There is some truth in that, you know, because many of the qualities which males have to develop to be successful relate to the things that testosterone does. It does make men more muscular and strong. And that's important, obviously, not just for competing with other males, but also hunting or fishing or shooting or defending themselves. It makes them take more risks. If you go to a ski resort, look at the off-piste skiers, nearly all of them are young males. If you watch people who skydive or surf, again, young males. Young males are attracted to risky things. And that's important too, the risks, for example, for taking a chance, exploring things, competing. Competing is always a risk because you never know whether you may lose. So without any risk-taking, which young males do, society will be much poorer off. People taking risks are those, like entrepreneurs, which develop society, which make it bigger, which explore things, and which, of course, sometimes invade other people's property or territory and therefore may or may not benefit the society to which they belong.
But it plays a role for women as well.
Oh, yes. And that's not very often recognised. This idea of male and female hormones, you know, is outdated. You talked a moment ago about estrogen as a female hormone. Not so, because the male brain, for example, turns quite a lot of its testosterone into estrogen before it uses it. And the female, as you've just said, needs testosterone for sexual drive. That's rather remarkable because it's not true for most other mammals.
And you cover in the book some quite difficult areas to write about. You cover sexual crime and street gangs and the role testosterone might play in those.
Because testosterone is such a powerful hormone, because it has all these actions, it permeates every bit of our lives, both our personal lives. A lot of what men do is actually driven by their testosterone. Not always, but a lot of it is. But of course, because males have this ability to join together in groups, which is very common in males, football clubs, societies, golf clubs, and of course street gangs, these are all examples of this important property of particularly young males to bond together. Because this happens, this can be good or bad. It can be good in the sense that the males will bond together to defend their village, for example, or their people from attack. It can be bad in the sense that they can form subculture groups, which are what street gangs are, which exist largely to commit crime or to beat up other street gangs.
Research is continuing in this area, obviously. Yes. Is there any big finding that you're expecting or looking forward to in the near future on this area?
A lot of the interest at the moment in testosterone is not so much on its action on in sexuality, which is still a great interest. But the question is, how does that happen in the brain? Now, we know the parts of the brain that testosterone acts on. We can tell that by looking at the areas of the brain which respond to testosterone, and we know where they are. But that's not enough. How does this translate itself into I feel sexy, or I feel aggressive, or I feel get up and go, or I want to found a new company? So that's one big question. The other big question, of course, is how testosterone plays its role in other aspects of human lives. For example, finance, which is a good one.
What do you mean by that?
Well, as you know, a lot of finance involves taking risks, gambling, basically. You remember the rogue traders who broke the bank, the Barings Bank, for example. There is an interest now in the role that testosterone plays in the way in which men handle their professional financial dealings, the degree to which they are competitive or risk takers or so on, and how they make decisions. There's a very interesting paper that's just come out, and what they did was they gave a lot of men, over 200, a single dose of testosterone, and then they exposed them to a number of tests. And what they were doing is they were testing whether or not testosterone made men more likely to make an intuitive decision rather than a rational or logical one, a decision off the hoof. And I'll give you an example of this and see if you can do it. One of the tests they applied was this one. The cost of a bat and a ball together is £1.10. If the bat costs £1 more than the ball, how much does the ball cost?
Oh, my goodness. Well, 10 pence.
Wrong.
I thought it was wrong.
It's actually 5 pence. Now, 10 pence is the obvious intuitive answer. Now, when they tested all these men, they found that many more of them said 10 pence than those that hadn't had testosterone. In other words, testosterone may you go for the intuitive, rapid, first, impulsive response. Isn't that interesting?
That's interesting, yes. I'm glad I wasn't alone in that.
You want the right gender either, but there we are.
Yeah, we are strong on intuition. I'm pretty rubbish at maths. That's me, but not Joe Herbert. His book, Testosterone, is published by Oxford University Press. Well, we're coming to the end of our time with you on Bookmark, just in miles, I'm afraid. What is next for you? Where are you off to next?
Next for me is back out to the Middle East. And then what am I doing? Iceland, then a month in the Arctic in February, and then back across Europe in end of April, start of May.
And how long can you do this for? When will you stop?
I'm 44 now, 45 in January. I don't know. But who knows? Whenever my body decides it can't do any more, I've got bits missing and bits falling off and bionic bits fitted. Who knows?
It's quite a nice life you have, because as you said earlier, you kind of balance this exploring with doing corporate presentations.
It's a bit of a Forrest Gump life, really. I've got it leads to all sorts of opportunities. So my income is from giving corporate presentations about all manner of subjects, but all based around my sort of my adventures, my life as the backdrop. And then I get to do things like earlier this year, I
I presented the Duke of Edinburgh Gold Awards with Prince Philip. I get to speak on international stage with Sheikh Mohsen bin Nasser. I've spoken in front of Barack Obama and David Cameron and Gordon Brown. It's very, very, very much a strange life.
Well, speaking in front of Barack Obama, such an orator, gosh, what? How nervous, but what a privilege as well.
I didn't actually realise he was there.
That's probably a good thing, isn't it?
Probably.
And more books?
There's a couple more books that are sort of trickling on. Another children's book. I've just started working with an author illustrator to do something for younger children, a sort of 3 to 7 age group. Mine are sort of 7 to 12. And then a couple of books for grown-ups. I've written or contributed towards books by some business people anyway, like Richard Denny's Selling to Win, which is a fantastic book. And not just because I wrote in it, obviously. but then I've got a couple of grown-up books on my own.
And we ask this question of all our guests. What are you reading at the moment?
Aside from The Times...
Aside from The Times, of course.
Aside from The Times, I'm reading a book called Creating Innovators, which is by a Harvard professor called Tony Wagner. I met Tony in 2014, really interesting guy, doing some groundbreaking work looking at how we could challenge education to make education fit the current requirements rather than the rather archaic system we've got.
And do you have a hero? A final question to you, really. Do you have, you know, a role model that you look up to? Because you will be a role model for many of the children that you speak to.
I don't really believe in heroes and role models. You know, be your own person, get out there, make it happen for you. Take lessons from other people. Take lessons from other people's successes and failures, and your own, of course. But be your own person.
Well said. Well, our next show on Bookmark, the studio guest is historian Claire Mulley. She'll be talking about her book, The Women Who Flew for Hitler. We'll also hear from Daisy Johnston. She's the poet in residence for the A14. Yes, the A14. And we'll be talking to Karen Freeborn about her novel, Presenting the Fabulous O'Learys. In the meantime, go to our Facebook page, like us there. All podcasts of previous show are on the Cambridge 105 radio website, which is cambridge105.co.uk. And do go to the Heffers Bookshop website as well to find out about all the fabulous events going on there. But we're going to sign out now, Justine, with your last choice of music, which is the Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber. Why this one?
This is my go-to track when life's become a little bit stressful. It's a stressful place inside my mind. Turn all the lights off, lay on the floor in front of the fire, put this on. It's fantastic.